Support the Bartholomew Town Podcast by subscribing, rating, and reviewing on Apple Podcasts.
This is the Bartholomew Town Podcast.
Welcome in to another edition of the Bartholomew Town Podcast. I'm your host, Bill Bartholomew. On today's episode, I sit down with United States Congressman Jim Langevin. James Langevin is the United States Representative for Rhode Island's 2nd Congressional District, a post he has held since 2001. Langevin served in several key roles in state government before his election to Congress, where he is a member of the House Armed Services and Homeland Security Committees. A legacy figure in Rhode Island and beyond, Congressman Langevin is the first quadriplegic to serve in Congress and became the first quadriplegic appointed Speaker pro tempore during the 116th Congress. New episodes of the Bartholomew Town Podcast every Tuesday and Friday. Subscribe on Apple or wherever you listen to podcasts, or visit bartholomewtown.com or ripodcast.com. All right, there's a little bit of white noise on the audio for this episode. I did my best to eliminate it without making it sound too much like we were inside a can when this took place. That's because we had some heaters blasting. It was a little frigid out. You know, New England in the winter, it happens. But without further ado, my conversation with Congressman Jim Langevin.
First of all, thank you for having me on the program. I've been looking forward to our discussion for a while, and I'm glad we were able to put this together. So I guess to sum it up, I've been involved in elective office, public service for most of my adult life, although I definitely did not think that this was going to be my chosen profession, what I planned to do with my life. I realized the importance of public service at a very young age, but for me, I thought that was going to be being involved in law enforcement. I'm only sure if it started as a police cadet and Explorer Scout program at the local police station here in Warwick. And we would take classes from January to June every year, and then in June we'd take a test, and the top 10 high scorers were given jobs for the summer. Didn't pay much, we had a stipend each week, but it was a great program. And so I started when I was 13. I was involved till I was 16. And I had really fallen in love with law enforcement, thought that's what I was going to do with my career. But unfortunately, as in life, things don't always turn out as we think they're going to, as we plan. And in my case, unfortunately, I was in the police locker room in the afternoon. Two police officers looking at a new weapon that one of them had just purchased. The other officer was looking at it, didn't realize it was a bullet in the pipe, if you will, and he pulled the trigger to test it, and the bullet ricocheted off the locker, went through my neck, and severed my spinal cord. So I've been paralyzed ever since. That was in 1980, and you can imagine, it quickly ended my dream of law enforcement. Although it was a challenging time, a difficult time to go through the transition of, you know, what my life was going to be, new adjustments, both physical and otherwise, and one of the biggest things is what am I going to do with my life now? I was very fortunate to have an incredibly supportive community that rallied around me and my family at a time when we needed it the most. And that had a profound impact on me and showed me what people can do when they care about making a difference in someone's life. And to me, I guess that's the essence of what public service is all about. How do we make a difference in our community? And for myself, I said, you know, if I can ever do something to give back, I would want to do that. I'm going to try and jump at the chance. And it happened that one thing led to another, and I started getting more and more interested in government and public service. And it was suggested at one point I might want to try my hand at running for political office. And I did. In 1984, the voters of Rhode Island, every 10 years, are asked if they want to hold a constitutional convention to amend or redraft the Constitution. And in 1984, the voters said yes. In 1985, there was a special election to elect 100 delegates, one for each state rep district that we had. At the time, we had 100 districts. Now we have 75 state rep districts, but 70, there were 100 at the time, and I was one of the people that ran and was elected. And that was my foray into running for public office. And just to wind it up, I found that not only was I enjoying, felt like I was giving back and making a difference representing people, but I also found something I really enjoyed and began to develop a passion for. A couple years later, although that was just a one-year position, 1988, local state rep in my area decided not to run for re-election. I ran, was elected, and served in the General Assembly for 6 years. And then after I finished up my master's degree, I ran for statewide office as Secretary of State, and I was elected there and held that office for 6 years, getting re-elected once in 1998. And then in 2000, ran for Congress. And, thankfully, I was successful there as well, and people have placed their trust and confidence in me, for which I'm very grateful. And I've been doing that ever since, and I'm so proud to be able to represent Rhode Island in the United States Congress.
Was your opponent John Mattson in 2000?
No. Let's see. John has run once or twice, and there were three other primary opponents at the time. It was Kate Quinn McCoy, Kevin McAllister, and Angel Taveras were my opponents. And then in the general election, I believe that Rodney Driver might have been my Republican opponent. He either in then or Rodney had run a couple times against me. I think he was the Republican opponent at the time.
Yeah,
if I remember correctly.
Interesting time for me. It's when I really just started to understand what was going on around me. I was probably in seventh grade, and seventh or eighth grade at that point. So it was just as my awareness was beginning to happen that you were entering federal office. What's your relationship like with the other federal officials that we have here? Obviously, Congressman Cicilline, Senator Whitehouse, Senator Reid. You've been there basically my entire adult life, in one way or another. Obviously, Senator Whitehouse entering in 2006, but you've been there for a long time. You're an old guard, and Rhode Islanders love you, decidedly. What's that like? What's that experience like?
Thank you. Well, as I said, I'm very honored to have the trust and support of the people of Rhode Island who elected me and re-elected me time and again. And the responsibility is never lost on me, and the gratitude I have for people believing in me and supporting me in what I'm doing. And I have a great relationship with my colleagues in the delegation, Senator Reid, who's been in the Congress, thankfully, longer than I have. He's the more senior of all the members of the delegation. But I enjoy working with Senator Reid and Sheldon and with David. And the four of us, again, always have Rhode Island's interests at heart. We're generally on all issues, we're pulling the oars in the same direction. How can we best represent Rhode Island? And on that, whether it's Jack or Sheldon or David and myself, we have a great relationship. We're strong colleagues. And it's not that way in every other state. But we're fortunate in that respect. So it makes my job easier, and we're all working together.
Right. Plus the proximity. Obviously, there's four of you, and you have the population is a lot of access to each of you at any given point in time. The physical size, but also our mental size. You just feel very close to your elected officials all the way up to those who are in Washington. Do you experience that a lot?
Sure. I mean, the fact that Rhode Island is such a small state, everybody kind of knows each other, or we're related to each other, a person and a half removed, I guess they'd say, one half removed, that it does help that we can all get along, and that's one of the benefits of a small state. Rhode Islanders do have access to their top elected officials, and when they say, gee, the next time I see the governor or my congressman or senator, I'm going to let them know how I feel, for good or bad, they mean it, and they're able to do that, and that's a good thing.
Right, it really is. It's an accountability factor that's almost another layer of the media, just the human accountability, human-to-human accountability.
It's another reason why I come home every weekend, with rare exception. Unless I'm traveling on business or have to stay in D.C., but that's rare that I stay in Washington. Almost every weekend I'm back home. It's important to stay in touch with people. As much as I love the work in Washington, I'm on usually the first plane out of there coming home, and being back here, this is my home, and this is my family and friends are, and I like being back in Rhode Island as often as I can.
As far as when you're in Washington, right now is a very specific time for House Democrats, of course, just in terms of historically and politically. Do you feel that your role is sort of a containment role in terms of not letting the pendulum swing too far to the right or left right now, the way that it seems a little bit unsettled right now politically, the U.S., to say the least. Do you feel like you're sort of in the middle there trying to hold ground and move forward?
Sure. Always want to try to make steady progress and create and take advantage of the momentum if we can solve problems, that needs to be our focus, clearly. It is a very divisive time politically, both across the country and in Washington. The president especially has given rise to a lot of this this divisiveness and has fueled it, and that's an unfortunate side, part of the political situation in D.C. It's a challenging aspect of politics right now. But I would say this, that it's not all bad news, and that there are bipartisan things that are still happening, and on every major issue that I work on, I can point to a Republican co-sponsor or partner in the effort. I look at career and technical education. Had some big wins on job training for the 21st century with reauthorization of the Perkins Act. I've got a great colleague in Glenn Thompson, G.T. Thompson from Pennsylvania, a Republican colleague of mine we're proud to work with, and he and I co-chair the Career and Technical Education Caucus together. On cybersecurity, Republican Congressman Mike McCall from Texas, he and I co-chair the Cybersecurity Caucus. And on election reform issues and strengthening our election systems, of all people, Mark Meadows, the leader of the Tea Party, or the Freedom Caucus in Congress, he and I co-sponsored a bill last year. So those are just some highlights, but most of my work centers on and focuses on national security, since I sit on both as a senior member of the House Armed Services Committee and also a senior member of the Homeland Security Committee. Most of my work is centered on that issue. And if you're ever going to find bipartisanship, it's in the field of national security. How do we keep the country safe? How do we support and protect our men and women in uniform, help them do their job effectively? And so I take great comfort in the fact that those are bipartisan issues, and we're making progress.
Right. It seems like that national security and environmental issues should be entirely apolitical. Is that how you view your role? Is really,
sure.
really above any political goals?
Well, I mean, I see my role. I tend to be more of a centrist, and I'm a policy wonk, if you will. I want to solve problems, and I look to Senator Pell as my role model in politics. And I've interned with Senator Pell a couple of times when I was in college. He was a gentleman, a statesman, and someone that I admired. And the one thing about Senator Pell you would acknowledge is that people would say, he really didn't care who got the credit. It was about getting the job done. He was committed to public service. He was the consummate statesman. And I tried to model my actions in Congress much in the way he conducted himself as a senior senator for several decades.
Yeah, the Rhode Island, even the Rhode Island Republican of yesteryear, something that I've been fascinated by recently, just thinking about the intersection of the progressive ideology and the libertarian ideology and where that lives and where Rhode Islanders actually live right now. Do you have a sense of politically where Rhode Islanders live at this very moment?
Again, I suppose it depends on the issues. Rhode Island, I think, tends to be more liberal in their political leanings, and certainly independent. But my district tends to be more conservative than my colleague Congressman Cicilline's district. If you looked at the election map after the 2016 elections, that it very much looked like the map of the country, where the coast was blue and the interior was red, and that's what the map looked like. And who voted for Donald Trump, for example, who voted Republican. So my district is probably more balanced than Rhode Island, perhaps as a whole. But we still have the highest percentage, as I recall, when I was Secretary of State, still the highest percentage per capita of registered independent or unaffiliated voters of most any other state in the country. It's over 50%, as I recall, of our voters are registered as independent or unaffiliated.
Absolutely, yeah, it's vastly more than anyone with a party affiliation, that's for sure. With regards to border security, which is, there's been the almost tabloid level version of it that's been pushed out by the president, but there are issues as well with border security as far as how that relates to national security. In Rhode Island, I don't think on a day-to-day basis it's something that most people are thinking about. They're certainly thinking about immigration from either side. but not so much the border security aspect of it, maybe within the context of the opioid crisis. But what's your message to Rhode Islanders about what we really need to do when it comes to border security, and what can you do from your position?
Well, there's a lot of agreement between Democrats and Republicans on security. We want a stronger border security. The question is, how do we best achieve border security? What's going to be most effective in terms of fixing our broken immigration system? You know, sure, we want people to abide by the law of coming in and leaving according to our laws. But there's a right way to do it and a wrong way. And we don't want to just squander resources, for example, to build an artificial wall on our southern border that is not necessarily going to be the wisest way to spend our dollars. And we can achieve border security without necessarily spending billions and billions of dollars on a border wall. We can use all types of technology, sensors and drones and certain border patrol agents. What people need to really remember is that the vast majority of the people who come into the country and wind up being here illegally actually start out by coming in legally and just don't leave. So if I think it was in 2017, more than two-thirds came in legally. They either drove in with a visa, a visitor visa, or some other legal means of being here, or they flew in here, or came by boat, or came in legally, and they just overstayed their visa. So that, you know, the border wall is not going to get to the stronger entry and exit system, and other issues with, again, we need to look at immigration reform. The president's way of a political promise to build a wall, and it's not necessarily the most effective and efficient way of achieving border security.
Absolutely. To legally immigrate to the United States is a daunting process, and it's an expensive one. My wife is Brazilian, and just going through that process was, we did it without an attorney. I did it, so you can imagine me at 3 o'clock in the morning filling out paperwork just to save money, but doesn't it seem like that's an area to visit, that process, and how can you better serve people who, probably half those people who overstay their visa would love the opportunity to go through the process. They just can't afford it or can't understand how to attack that process. Do you feel like that could be cleaned up?
Yes, it could. That's part of immigration reform and also the per country caps on who can come here and work here legally, and that's all part of this broken system that we need to fix. By the way, it makes no sense in my mind that we allow so many people to come here from around the world to study, which I certainly support, but then as soon as their education is completed, and irrespective of whether they have a skill that we need in the country, or whether they're going to start a company and create jobs, we tell them they've got to leave right away. And it's, you know, again, part of our broken immigration system. We have a couple of very talented researchers and doctors at Brown University, for example, and they're from India, and they are not able to stay because the per country cap, we've already hit that, and they're not, they've it would be, it's been years that they've been trying to find a way to be here, be able to work legally and be able to contribute their talents and their research to solving human health problems. So we're working on that issue with them. But again, the per country cap is another issue that's a challenge.
Absolutely. And to work in the shadows and to exist in the shadows is an unpleasant experience. I feel like I hear a lot of, you know, talk radio fodder, but it really suggests that it's a convenient thing to illegally immigrate to the United States, and it just gets tiresome, and the policy is lost. And as a policy junkie yourself, I'm sure you can appreciate how we've got to refocus it.
And we came close, by the way, several years ago. The Senate passed an overwhelming bipartisan immigration reform bill, and unfortunately, because of, I think, antiquated and rules that are very frustrating, and we have one person, the Speaker of the House, decides what bills are going to come up for a vote. We never even had a chance to debate a vote on that immigration reform bill. Had the Speaker brought it up, that that bill would have passed, and that President Obama would have signed it into law, and again, we never got the opportunity. And that's because the Republicans have this this rule that they would not bring up any issue. It's called the Hastert rule. They wouldn't bring up any bill for a debate or a vote that didn't have a majority of their majority. So it's a consequence. We only have the most conservative issues that ever even made it to the floor. And that's unfortunate. It's not the way the process should work.
Extremely poor. Last few minutes here, do we have another five or so? Is that okay? Rhode Island right now, to me, it's in this exciting transformational period here. It's almost like Slater Mill 2 is about to open up somewhere. We don't know what it is or what it's going to be, but people are moving back. In my mind, people are moving back. Younger people are moving back to Providence and Newport at a higher rate. It seems like ideas are starting to flow here. What can be done to support the next wave of industries in Rhode Island from the federal level?
Well, we certainly want people to be successful, and education is always going to be an important part of the equation. And so making it affordable for people to go to school, get an advanced education, or advanced training in job skills. And so one of the things that I've championed in the Congress is making sure that our workforce has 21st century skills for a 21st century economy. G.T. Thompson and I, my Republican colleague, just recently passed the reauthorization of the Perkins Act. It's a Career and Technical Education for the 21st Century Act, and it better aligns what we're teaching in schools and the skills that businesses need. And that act had not been reauthorized for 10 years, and finally, after several years of trying, we finally got it through. So, that came about because I was going around the state back at the height of the recession, the Great Recession, 2007, 2008, and asking businesses when they would be hiring. And they all the time telling me that we were hiring now, but we were struggling to find people with the right skills for the jobs that we need. Manufacturing, for example, has totally changed and revolutionized. It's more advanced manufacturing, working with robotics, computer programming, CNC machines. And these take advanced skills as not at the old dirty factories that our fathers or grandfathers were familiar with. So, but again, making sure that our workers have the right skills to do the jobs that are available now and in the future, that our young people can afford to go to school, whether it's to a four-year college or to a certificate or degree program. We want to make sure that we have an educated workforce. So that's a top priority of mine. But looking at other ways that we can support small businesses and making it make sure they have access to capital, and that Rhode Island is a business-friendly climate. That's certainly that all elected officials are interested in. And so wherever we can work with our state leaders on those issues, as well as the federal delegation, that's definitely a primary focus of what we're doing.
And I guess my last question would be, is if you're back in Rhode Island, you have free time, what's your day like? What would you like to do, if you don't mind?
Well, spending time with family and friends is important. But, you know, especially with the summertime around Rhode Island, and on rare days when I can get to the beach and relax, that's awfully nice. I don't get that many beach days in, especially if it's an auction year.
What's your favorite beach?
I usually go to Bonnet Shores. My family's been going there for many years, so we won't generally go down there. But there's all kinds of festivals and things going on around that I like to take advantage of. Just relaxing reading is something I like to do. Every once in a while, I'll get out and play pool or something. In fact, I just was out recently with Mayor Lawrence, and he and I played a few rounds of pool together.
So, oh, awesome.
Yeah, it was a fun, relaxing night out. He cleaned my clock, but we had a good time.
I saw you at the new Water Fire Center for Mayor Lawrence's, must have been his inauguration bash or something like that, but it was a wild scene, and you were right in the thick of it. The extraordinary rendition band was marching around, and it was nutty, and you were having a great time.
Mayor Lawrence knows how to throw a party.
He does.
I'll tell you, there's so much going on in Rhode Island. It's showing the city. Providence is alive, and there's PBD Fest, or Water Fire. So when I get to, I get to Water Fire, that's always a fun time. The main other things that Rhode Island has to offer, my hometown of Warwick, it's a great city. I've worked with Mayor Solomon. Proud to have him as my mayor, first Democratic mayor in about 20 years in Rhode Island, but proud to be working with him. And, Council President Maroli. So we get a great delegation in the State House and the Senate too in Rhode Island, as well as our federal delegation. So again, I'm honored to be able to represent Rhode Island in Congress, and I couldn't imagine living anywhere else but for Rhode Island. I'm proud to call Rhode Island my home.
Well, your dedication and the camaraderie and the you know, it's not like everyone agrees on every single issue or is pushing the exact same agenda on the state or federal level, but it shows, and it does give us, you know, for a small state, it gives us a lot of power, and I appreciate it a lot.
Thank you.
Congressman Lanchman, thank you so much for your time.
Great to be with you today.
That's all for this episode of the Bartholomew Town Podcast, but I'll be back on Friday with a brand new episode. Until then, I'm Bill Bartholomew. We'll talk soon.
At HealthSource RI for Employers, we provide access to health insurance to more than 1,100 local businesses and nonprofits, and 96% of them renew through us every year. Maybe it's our choice of 19 different health plans, our 10 years of customizing solutions, or our one local team of dedicated experts helping employers find quality health insurance. See how our numbers stack up for you. Learn more at healthsourceri.com/employers.